is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We welcome you to the second case of this month's oral arguments. 12-AP-641, Julie Augsburger versus Homestead Mutual. Arguing for 25 minutes on behalf of Contos and Homestead Mutual is Jared J. Papendorf. Arguing on behalf of Julie Augsburger is Susan Tindall, who has 30 minutes, and Mr. Papendorf will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
Please, the court. My name is Jared Papendorf, and I'm a member of the Menn Law Firm in Appleton. And I represent Mr. George Contos, the petitioner in this action, and his insurance company, Homestead Mutual. This matter involves a de novo appeal from a Court of Appeals decision, District 2, dated August 23, 2013. In terms of the facts underlying this case, I'll be brief because they're fairly undisputed. This dog bite incident occurred on June 21st, 2008. George Contos is the father of the co-defendant, Janet Bythe. In 2007, Mr. Contos' wife was sick, ill, and she wanted her daughter, Janet Bythe, to come back home to Wisconsin so she could be close. Janet Bythe had a similar desire to be close to her mother in her final days. Mr. Contos purchased a separate property, a Grandview property, to allow Janet Bythe, her husband Ed Bythe, and their daughter Jordan Bythe to return back to Wisconsin to be close to Mr. Contos' wife, Janet's mother. Mr. Contos never resided at that property. He has his own residence. It's about 7 miles away. He never was a cohabitant or resident of the Grandview property. Since the Vice moved back to Wisconsin in 2007, the Vice have lived there as a family unit as their residence. Mr. Contos, like I said, had his own residence 7 miles away. It's a different and distinct and separate residence for himself. The Vice never resided with him at his residence either. The Vice moved back to Wisconsin, and they had a couple dogs, and when they came back to Wisconsin, they acquired more. Mr. Contos has never had any legal possession or ownership of those dogs. Dogs have always resided, always lived at the Grandview property with the Vice. The record is clear that Mr. Contos never fed, never watered, never took care of the dogs in question. He never had custody of them or control of them. None of that took place at his house or at the Vice house, the Vice residence. Lastly, Mr. Contos wasn't present on the day of the accident, day of the dog bite, on June 21st, 2008. The issue presented in this case is a matter of first impression for Wisconsin. The issue is whether a landlord is liable for injuries caused by a dog owned and kept by another on premises on which the landowner doesn't reside. As Judge Riley stated in his dissent below, not a single case cited by the majority has found a person who resides in a home separate from the dog that caused the injury being the statutory owner of the dog solely by virtue of the person's ownership of the property where the dog resides with its legal owner. This is a de novo appeal both on the issue of whether Mr. Contos was a harborer and also application of the judicial public policy considerations understand it, interprets, this case interprets or involves Stash 174.
Mr. Papendorf, in regard to the issue of harboring, I view that as tied into the idea of control. And let me ask you, what control are we talking about? Are we talking about control of the animals, or are we talking about control of the premises?
Thank you. The control is of the dogs in question. And in this case, I believe that the issue of harborer has to have some modicum or measure of control of the dogs themselves. And that's borne out by a number of cases in Wisconsin and throughout the United States that talk about the issue of control. And the restatement second of torts talks about harboring requires an affirmative action to afford shelter, lodging, or refuge to a dog, and more than the presence of the dog on the property owner's premises. In Patterman, a homeowner allowed a dog in her home for a short period of time, and the court indicated there was no evidence that the homeowner fed or cared for the dog in any way. In the case cited by the majority from Minnesota, Anderson, that case also indicated a harborer must do more than exercise control over the land upon which a dog resides. The case of Erdman, which was a case involving a babysitter where a homeowner was both kept and harbored a dog in her home, that case stands for the fact that the homeowner, property owner, had the dog in her premises, not at some separate property. There's a recent case from Illinois decided in 2014, the Witten versus Luck case that we cite to. There, the court in Illinois said that the homeowner wasn't a harborer because the homeowner did not have the requisite care, custody, or control over the animal. So I believe that the issue of control, the issue of being a harborer has to have some modicum of control, custody, or care over the dog.
Well, in Pawlowski, I get pronounced that right. The homeowner allowed somebody else who owned the dog to live in the house. And the owner of the dog released, intentionally or unintentionally, I don't remember that from the facts, the dog and the dog from the house, and the dog bit somebody. The victim sued the homeowner. And the homeowner's defense was, hey, I had no control over that dog during this dog biting incident. I didn't let him out. I wasn't there. I couldn't stop the dog, et cetera. And the court said, too bad. The dog was in your home, residing with you. You took care of the dog. You may have fed the dog or provided the food. Therefore, you harbored the dog. So this concept of not control doesn't always protect the homeowner.
I think that this case, the Augsburger case, is distinguishable and dissimilar from the facts and circumstances in the Pawlowski case. And as this court indicated, that the interpretation has to look at the particular and peculiar facts of each case when making a decision as in terms of harbor. I believe this case is distinguishable from Pawlowski in a couple of different ways, and I'll address your question. Well, first, Your Honor, I believe that in that case, the Pawlowski case, Ms. Seafeld and Mr. Waterman resided in a separate and single individual residence together. He moved into her home with his dogs, and they lived there under one roof, not a separate residence. Secondly, Ms. Seafelt, the homeowner in Pulaski, actually exercised care, custody, and control over the waterman's dog, Mr. Waterman's dog. In this case, Mr. Contos and the Vice did not live together under one roof in a single residence, in an undivided residence, nor did he exercise any care, custody, or control over the Vice dog or dogs. The respondent alludes to one day when Mr. Contos yelled at the dogs to essentially shut up. I don't believe that is the type of care, custody, or control is necessary. In Pulaski, Seafelt provided shelter and lodging for the dog in the home where she resided. In this case, the sheltering and lodging of the dog by the Vice, the resident of the property, are the ones that provided the shelter and lodging and refuge for the dog in their own residence. Mr. Contos lived 7 miles away, had his own residence, was not a house guest nor cohabitant.
Are you arguing this is a landlord-tenant situation?
I believe it is, Your Honor.
How would you characterize the tenancy?
I believe that the tenancy would be considered a tenancy at will. And we cite that in our brief. I believe that the Vice should be considered a tenant at will as defined in Section 704, Sub 1, Sub 5, which says that any tenant holding with the permission of the tenant's landlord without a valid lease and under circumstances not including periodic payments. Here, we're not suggesting that there was a valid lease and there was not periodic payments, but we believe that there are tenants at will. Mr. Contos owned this residential property where his daughter and family lived, just as a landlord would own a residential property where a tenant could live. This case is very similar on the facts to the Carr versus Vanister case cited in my brief. That's a case from Kansas. And that case is important because the facts are the most similar to this case. In that case, a father purchased a separate piece of property for his son to live in. His son was disabled, and the father paid for the property and paid for the property taxes. But in that case, similar to our case, the dog or dogs were kept at the son's separate property, and the father didn't exercise any custody, care, or control over the dog. In that case, the landlord-tenant subjectivity or lack of liability applied because the father didn't exercise any care, custody, or control over the dog. So we believe that, yes, this is fits within the confines or decision of Smaxwell and is almost directly on point factually with the Carr versus Vanister case from Kansas that we cite to in our brief.
But unlike an apartment building or a different place like that, this is his house. I mean, he could say, I don't want any dogs there.
It's a property that he owns, but it's a resident of the Vice. And the Vice owned the dogs, and although the testimony is that he could have asked them to leave or asked the dogs to leave, the fact that a landlord doesn't or does ask a dog to leave or have provisions in a lease not requiring dogs does not obfuscate the non-liability of landlords for the bites of the tenant's dog.
I probably didn't ask that very
well. A little hard of hearing, so I apologize.
I probably didn't ask that very well. You know, if you have an income-producing property where you have a landlord-tenant relationship, you may be willing to have tenants who have animals, pets, dogs, and you may decide what kinds of pets and dogs or no dogs or no cats or whatever. But you make those decisions based upon an income-producing sort of analysis, I think, right, to fill it up and make sure that you can have that property produced the way you want it to. This really is his house, and he's just letting them stay there. So how do we bridge that gap? I mean, whether it doesn't matter that it's not an income-producing property, does it matter that it's really his home, does it matter that it's a place that he thinks he might live in the future, does it matter that it's his daughter?
I don't think it does, Your Honor. And the analogy that I would suggest to this court is someone that owns a separate piece of property, say a vacation home, and they allow a family friend or a family member to use that vacation home for a number of weeks or a month without being paid, and they have a dog that they take to the property, and the dog gets loose or bites a neighbor when it comes over. In that case, it's not an income-producing case, and I don't think in that situation that the vacation home owner should be found liable for the dog bite of the case simply because he allowed someone else to live in the home. Another analogy that would I think is appropriate is if a family owns a condo or something in Milwaukee or Madison, and they have a friend that has a sick child and has to be treated at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and the homeowner, the property owner, allows his family to live there gratis without paying anything, and they bring a dog. If that dog bites somebody, under the respondent's argument, that homeowner, that property owner, is harboring the dog because it provides a place for that family with their dog to live. And I don't believe that the way that harboring is talked about in Patterman and other cases cited in our brief, Erdman, Malone, and Kading, that there has to be some type of connection, some modicum of control to be a harborer.
Counsel, didn't Patterman, though, deal with this transient situation? It seems to me the examples that you gave are also transient in nature. Here, the facts are of a much longer duration. I look at the restatement definition, and harboring to afford lodging to shelter or to give refuge to a dog here. If I would strip away all of the legalese in this case, are they landlord, tenant, will, is it transient, is it of longer duration, so it's not transient, I see the facts here as a dad providing a place to live for his daughter and family. Now, I might be wrong, but that's the way I see the facts. I mean, come back home, got this place, I'm going to retire, that's why I have this place in Larson, but I'm not, you come and live here, mom's ill, you stay. So why doesn't that fit the definition of to afford lodging or shelter? Oh, the definition of harboring.
Sure. Mr. Kontos had his own residence. That's where he resided. He bought this piece of property for the Vice to maintain their own residence, and that's what they did on this piece of property. So they're...
Please. So,
yes, he allowed... the Vice or provided a place for the Vice to live, but they're the ones that provided the harboring to their dogs. They're the one that provided food. They're the ones that provided shelter. They're the ones that provided protection of the dog. And they're the ones that had control over the dog in terms of watering, feeding, taking care of it, et cetera. So in this case, yes, he did provide the property for the Vice to maintain a residence. But I think that case, in this case, it still fits within the landlord-tenant arena, is that you shouldn't be found liable simply by owning a piece of property when you have no control over the dog that the Vice owned.
Your opposing counsel on the issue of control, I think, advances the argument that you are commingling or confusing the definitions, that control and custody are elements of being a keeper as opposed to a harborer. control of the dog under Wisconsin case law, control of the dog and custody are elements of keeping. Can you respond to that, please?
And I understand that a lot of cases, even Pawlowski, talk about the commingling of the terms harbor or keeper. But the way I believe, Your Honor, the case law is that there's a legal owner of the dog, someone that owns the dog. The person that keeps the dog in terms of at their house, control and custody. And then there's a person that's a harborer that provides food, provides shelter for the dog. But as part of the definition of a harborer, as set forth in Patterman and Anderson and Gilbert, there's a component of control as part of harboring, such as Ms. Pawlowski, she invited the dogs into her own residence and they lived as essentially a family unit in her on her own property. So in Pawlowski, she provided harbor to the dog because they lived with her in her own property, and she maintained control over both the property and the dog. In this case, that's not the facts of this case.
Well, isn't this a lot of line drawing?
I'm sorry.
I said, isn't this a lot of line drawing? First of all, the cases say, Eastern Wisconsin, sometimes hard to tell the difference between keep and harbor. They're used interchangeably. Number two, at least in the restatement, and I think it continued in restatement third, as well as in the restatement second, that if it's a landlord-tenant relationship, the landlord is not liable for the dog bite. That here, in Pawlowski, you had living in the same house. The owner of the house did things for the dog, bought the food, may have fed him, I don't remember the details. In this case, you don't exactly have a landlord-tenant. Maybe you do, but maybe you don't. You got a family member allowing somebody to live in a separate residence, right?
Correct.
No rent, as best we can tell, either in money, in cash, or in services, or otherwise. So it's hard, it may be difficult to show landlord-tenant, but has some of the attributes of the landlord-tenant relationship, and raises the question that any time the owner of the property allows a dog, that owner is going to be, owner of the property is going to be liable for the dog, which gets you into your second argument about public policy, right?
Correct.
All right. So what kind of rule would you put into the case that you wrote that would draw the line so in the next case we don't get it? Because the line's there and everybody knows whether the dog is on one side of the bite rule or on the other.
Well, it's a difficult line to draw, obviously, because as the court said in Pawlowski, it's particular or peculiar cases have to be looked at by a case-by-case basis. But, Your Honor, I believe that in order for a landowner or landlord to be liable for the dog bite, there has to be control by the landowner or landlord over the dog itself, more than just owning the property and allowing someone to live there with a dog. And my arguments or my examples that I used previously about a vacation owner or perhaps a holdover tenant that doesn't pay rent or the children's hospital example that I used, if the court found that Mr. Contos is a harborer and therefore liable, I think that we're getting to a slippery slope where has no just or sensible stopping point, because in that case, my examples would ring true. Is that a vacation owner a piece of someone that owns a vacation home that allows someone to go there, whether it be a week or a month, and they have a dog, and that dog bites somebody, the landowner would be subject to liability. And the Muir versus Ogre case, if I'm saying that right, talks about the not converting 174 into an absolute liability over a homeowner or property owner for the bites of a dog. So getting back to your question, Madam Justice, Chief Justice, is in this case, there is testimony that there was some services provided, albeit not a lot, by Mr. Vyth in terms of maintenance of the property and plumbing and painting and remodeling. But certainly, it wasn't to the rise of someone would be paying rent. But as Judge Riley indicated in his dissent, there is more here than just there is a relationship, a landlord-tenant pro bono relationship. The reason why Mr. Contos bought this piece of property was to allow his daughter to come back to spend time and provide support for her dying mother. And so, albeit Mr. Contos buying this piece of property for the Vice to have their residence, that wouldn't have occurred. Thank you.
Counsel. Justice Prosser has a question.
Did Mr. Contos have insurance on the Grandview property?
He did.
He did. So if the property burned, for example, his insurance policy would have covered that?
I believe he would have insurance for damage to the property in terms of the fire.
Okay.
The underlying court, the trial court, I believe in its decision, and I don't have that right in front of me, but I believe there, as part of the case, we brought a motion that there wouldn't be coverage for the Vice, the residents of the property. And that was granted.
You represent the insurance company, don't you?
I represent Mr. Contos and Homestead Mutual, yes.
And
the Vice had separate counsel.
Pardon me?
The Vice, the Janet mm-hmm. and Ed Vyth, they had separate mm-hmm. counsel.
And if the court should find, should conclude, as the Court of Appeals concluded, that Mr. Contos is liable, is it clear under this, this is a summary judgment, that Homestead would have to pay? Or is that still an issue to be decided?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that question because the summary judgment addressed the issue of whether he was a...
Contos was liable and not whether Homestead is liable.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Ms. Tyndall?
The legislature has long held that dog owners are responsible for the acts of their dogs, and the legislature has seen fit to define dog owner to include not only the title owner of the dog, but also those who keep the dog and those who harbor the dog. For a long time, this court used the terms harboring and keeping interchangeably, but of late, cases have come before the court where this court and the Court of Appeals have had to address the difference between those two terms. And while this court in Pulowski said that the terms can be overlapping, the general principle here, and if you look at the ALR article on harboring and keeping, which we cited in our brief, the general rule is that harboring implies providing shelter, or lodging or refuge to a dog, while keeping involves an aspect of care, custody, or control. Therefore, under the Pulowski analysis, harboring does not require control the way keeping does. And that was what the Court of Appeals found in this case. Their conclusion was that the legislature included the term harboring, and that if they had not, and that keeping was required, they would find for Contos. But because that harboring was included in the statute, Judge Gundrum, who I believe is a former legislator, properly concluded that the statute requires liability here because Mr. Contos harbored the dog.
What's your best case for the proposition that someone who lives in a separate residence is liable for a dog who lives in the other residence?
Well, as this Court has explained on numerous occasions, each case has to be evaluated on its separate facts. This case has very unusual facts. And as counsel for Contos and Homestead explained, Mr. Contos purchased this property specifically for the Vies to live in. It wasn't that he bought it as a retirement home that he was going to live in and he had it available when the Vies needed a place. When they were going to come home, he purchased this house specifically because they had pets. And they needed a place where they could stay that could accommodate those pets, including the two dogs that they had at the time. And so this place was purchased specifically for them and their pets, which is different than a typical.
I don't know how relevant this is, but did he live in a place where it would have been impossible for him to have pets in his home?
That's not in the record.
Okay, fair enough. I don't want to know that.
So he purchased this particular property because of the pets, so that they could live there with their pets. So that is number one. Number two, when the Vies moved here, they moved into the house in February of 07. And the testimony in the record is that the earliest that either of the Vies had a job was either Mrs. Vies had a job, and she testified once that she began work in August of 07, and later she said October of 07. So they spent from February to at least August without any income. And the record is clear that Mr. Contos helped them pay their bills and helped them make their car payments and gave them, in addition to buying the house for them, letting them live there for free with no kind of landlord-tenant relationship, no written or unwritten agreement of any kind.
I wonder if you could go into a little more depth than that. Your opposing counsel, when he started in response to a question from Justice Eagler, asked about a tenancy at will. You said there was no landlord-tenant relationship. Why isn't this a tenancy at will?
Well, in the first instance, it was never argued as a tenant at will situation until the reply brief in this court. Mr. Vies testified that he was not the landlord of, or Mr. Contos testified that he wasn't the Vies landlord, and that there was no written or unwritten, formal or informal arrangement for rent. There was no agreement whatsoever. Mrs. Vies, his daughter, said, "He's not my landlord, he's my dad."
Yeah.
And so in the Town of Menominee versus Skubnitz case, which we cited to in our SIR reply brief, this court said that in order for a landlord-tenant relationship to exist, the parties have to intend that there be such a relationship. So our first position is they never contended until their reply brief in this court that there was any such tenancy at will. And so because they didn't raise it until now, the court should not consider it. If you do, under the Town of Menominee case, you cannot find a landlord-tenant relationship where the party specifically said that they didn't have that relationship. She said, "He's my dad, not my landlord." And therefore, because of that situation, that they didn't, they had no agreement whatsoever. And this isn't a commercial situation where a landlord has a piece of property which he then rents to whatever tenant he finds most suitable. This is a father who wants his daughter to come live in nearby, and he purchases this home specifically.
And such situations are not, I don't think they're that uncommon, especially in our more rural, perhaps farming communities, where one person or two, married couple, usually own the real estate, and they'll allow one of their children to build or build for them a home away from the main home so they can be close by, but yet it's economical for everybody. What is the legal relationship? I mean, if they say they're not tenant and landlord,
I mean, it's just a family situation. I mean, where I live, my house is the old farmhouse, and across the street, my neighbor lives in the house that her grandparents built when her parents had too many kids, and the farm expanded. It's essentially an extension of the family home on the same property in that particular case. And in this case, the home is an extension as well. He purchased this house for his daughter to live in so that she could be there close by and visit her mother. It was not purchased as a rental property. There was never an intent for that. He said he would maybe retire there. But so their legal relationship was never addressed until...
Do you think the result should be the same if the property owner was not her dad, but all the other circumstances were the same, i.e. he never lived there, she never paid rent, she moved into the property, but the person that owned the property had their own reasons for wanting it occupied rather than empty.
And
but there's no family, no rent, no family relationship. You think the result should be the same?
Well, one of the things that all, I mean, when we consider the dog bite cases, one of the things is that all the facts have to be considered. Mm-hmm. And here, he helped pay her bills. Which
Why
is,
does that make him liable for a dog bite? Because he made her car payments.
Well, and he helped pay all her bills. She had no, they had no income for like 6 months.
Parents often help their children when they're not employed. Having three adult children myself, I can tell you, parents help their kids. But that generally, I mean, that he paid her bills, I see very disconnected from whether or not he should be liable for the dog bite because he was the lawful owner of the property.
But what I'm trying to say, and perhaps I'm not saying it artfully, is that we can't consider these facts all in little isolated bits, but we have to consider the totality of the facts. He purchased the house specifically for them to live with pets.
I understand your argument. I think you said it very well in your brief, and I totally get it. So totality of the circumstances, and we are very fond of that standard, and I totally understand what you're telling me. I'm just trying to figure out which of the facts you think is most important. So the facts I'm changing on you are the person that owns the property has no relationship, familial, with this occupier. You know, it's not a family relationship driven by family concerns. We don't know why this person wants the property occupied rather than vacant. If those were the facts, do you think the result should be the same? In other words, the property owner would still be liable for the bite of the dog.
Yes, because...
Okay, good. Thanks.
The Court of Appeals said, and I believe it's in paragraphs 12 and 13 of their decision, that the test is, did the person knowingly provide shelter or lodging for the dogs? And they said that Mr. Contos did do that. And the circuit court said, there's no question that Mr. Contos provided shelter for the dogs. So the fact that it's a family relationship, in my opinion, helps to clarify that in this situation it's a family relationship and he's providing assistance and shelter for the family and the pets as part of his family. But if the person who owns the property is providing shelter to the dogs knowingly, and here remember too, it's a permanent shelter. This wasn't a situation where the dogs were going to come in for a week or a couple nights. He provided permanent shelter for the dogs. For three of those dogs, this was the only home they had ever had. They were puppies that were born there. The house was purchased when the Veith already had two dogs.
Two horses, I think.
And two horses.
Couldn't
yes.
it also, you said that he, I'm sorry.
No, I'm done. I'm done. She answered, but I asked her to help me with
it. You said that Contos provided shelter for the dogs. I guess another way of saying it is Mr. Contos provided shelter for his daughter and her family, and they brought dogs in. And it seems to me one of the bases of your argument is that Mr. Contos could have told his daughter and their family to get rid of the dogs.
That's true. That is one of the bases for arguments. In my understanding of Pawlowski. Pawlowski says that harboring is providing shelter or lodging.
That's the case where they were living together.
Where they were living together. But it does not say that harboring requires control. So it's our contention that there's no requirement of control under just harboring, that is keeping.
Isn't that one of the hallmarks, though, of a landlord-tenant relationship? where if, you know, I happen to rent, I rent an apartment, and, you know, it's in the contract, it says if you want a dog, you can have one, it'll cost you an extra $20 a month. So that landlord controls. The contract could equally say no dogs.
Well, this court has usually held on public policy grounds in cases typically where it's a common law argument, not a statutory argument, that public policy relieves landlords from liability for their dogs. And that is because in that case, the tenant usually has control over the premises. But here, Mr. Contos kept his boat there. He visited there. His daughter testified, it's his house. We live there. And he testified, it's my property. I can kick them out if I want to. So Mr. Contos has control over the property in a way that a typical landlord does not. And that's one of the distinctions between this case and a commercial or even a non-commercial landlord situation. But the point I was going to make before...
he kept his boat there and he visited often those...
As part of the whole package of facts, yes, he had control in a way that other landlords didn't, based particularly on the testimony, it's his house, we live in it, and his testimony...
I didn't see any part in the transcript if he was questioned about what the procedure was when he did come to visit. Did he walk right in the house? Did he wait for permission? Did he knock?
That's not in the record.
Okay.
Counsel Justice Prosser has a question or comment.
I'm sorry.
Could I ask you to address opposing counsel's hypothetical about vacation property?
Yes, I'm done. Yes.
A parent or an uncle, like me, has vacation property, and what is the implication if that owner permits the use of that vacation property to relatives who have a dog?
Well, again, under the Court of Appeals analysis, it's whether there's knowingly sheltering the dog. But one of the distinctions in this case that I think was important and makes this case so unique is that the property was actually purchased to accommodate the pets, including the two dogs. Whereas in the rental home situation, if you're just allowing your relatives to visit and they bring their dog, it's not that you bought that property because they had a dog and you wanted them to be able to bring it. And, you know, that's one aspect. And the other aspect, too, here is that this is a permanent – there was never an intent that this just be a temporary two-week thing. The fact that this was a permanent home for these dogs and was intended to be a permanent home is a big distinction in our view that you don't have with the vacation situation. And that's, you know, again, it's a totality of the circumstances that one has to consider. So when you're saying they were bringing their dog, it was only a couple weeks, was there an intent on the part of the homeowner to shelter the dog? That would be a different situation, I think, than here, where the home was specifically purchased to accommodate the pets, and the homeowner was providing support for the family because they didn't have any money, and it was intended to be permanent.
Let me just ask point blank. If I own vacation property and I allowed some family members, not part of my own household, but other family members to use that property for a week, and they had dogs, and the dogs bit somebody, am I going to be liable?
Well, I don't think so, because in that situation, you're not sheltering the dogs in the same manner that we have here, where there was a knowing sheltering of the dogs. There was an intent to purchase the home to accommodate the dogs. There was financial support so that the Vs and their family and their pets could eat and whatnot. So if you give the whole view of these facts, that doesn't fit as neatly into a package where there's a one-week situation. And
this seems like a gift. Now that you're talking about it in this way, it seems like a gift, a lot like a week would be a gift.
But this is at the time this person got bit, this was almost a year and a half long.
It's a big gift.
And the big point here is, what is a harbor?
What's the difference? Is there a time limit? If it's a week, then it's not, you're not responsible, but if it's a year without paying, you are?
I think it's the intent to shelter the animal. So Mr. Contos bought this property with the intent that the pets would live there, to accommodate the pets. Mrs. Cecil in Pulowski allowed Mr. Waterman to live in her home. He didn't have a job, and he needed a place to live that could accommodate his dog.
The difference has to be, in your analysis, is that he's still the owner. Because if you bought this and you gave it to your kids,
and
if you just signed it over to them, he would have zero ownership. But it's not the fact that he bought it and thought it'd be great for them to have their pets there that makes the difference. It's the fact that he bought it and he didn't fully give it over to them, title and ownership. So it's really the title and ownership that makes the difference in your situation.
No, that's part of it. It's he owned the property and he retained that control. But he also retained the control over the dogs to say whether or not they could come or go. And as I said,
how do you get there?
There's testimony in the record. Could he tell you to get rid of the dogs? Yes. Could he kick you out? Yes. He said, I could kick them out. It's my property. I can kick the dogs out. It's my property.
Well, so can a landlord.
Right. But in Ketting versus Conroy, this court said that the ability to kick the dog out or to say that it can't be fed from your table is sufficient control to make a person a keeper under the statute. And so when the defendants cite cases from other jurisdictions or the restatement that say that is insufficient amount of control to create liability, Wisconsin law has been to the contrary since 1936. So under Pulowski, harboring doesn't require control, but if it was to require control under Ketting, he had that control under the testimony of both Levice and Contos.
Okay, because he owns it or he pays the bills for the property.
Yeah, but isn't
so
that...
if I have a son who goes off to college and I pay his rent and he has a dog, they come after me because I pay his rent.
Well, again, are you knowingly providing shelter and lodging to the dog? I mean, I go back to, and that's one of the reasons why we argued against even granting review. This is such an unusual set of facts because this particular property was picked because of the animals. They were allowed to live there in this particular place because of the animals. And that's your son at college, my son, who's a few blocks away at college, hoping he doesn't get a dog.
I don't know if that's not the issue today anyway, but I'm just curious. So it's the fact that he owns the property that makes him the keeper.
It's not, no, it's that he owns the property and he intended that they live there with pets. He knew they had pets. It was purchased because of the pets, because they had to have a place to live where the pets could live. And he provided financial support. And he had the ability to say, you got to get rid of those dogs, or you got to do something about those dogs. And there's testimony that there was a dog door, and it appears that that's how the dogs got out. So he could have said, board up the dog door or put them on a leash if they're going to be outside. The legislature made the statute in order to require people who had the ability to control the dog, which he does, according to Ketting, to make him do that. To make a conscious choice to make a rule or tell a person you're allowing to keep a dog in your place, you gotta put the dog on the leash if you're gonna take it out. You have to.
So control of the dog is the same then. I think of control of the dog as, I'm in the same house with someone. I opened the door. I didn't put the dog in the cage before I did. I should have done that. The dog ran out and bit someone. It's not my dog. My roommate's dog, but still, I let the dog out. That's control.
That's keeping.
Now, he could control whether dogs were allowed on the premises, a lot like a landlord can control dogs on a premises. He could have said no dogs, but once dogs are there, what did he do to control what the dogs could or couldn't do?
Well, the testimony is that he didn't really do anything. I mean, he should have, and he had the power. I mean, that's the He had the power to have control. That was the testimony, and he didn't do anything.
Well, he had control over whether they existed on the premises, like a landlord does. But did he have control as to how they manage the dogs when they're on the premises? Did he have the ability to say, okay, every time someone comes to your door, I'm going to be there and I want to lock the dog up first? I mean, I'm not getting the distinction at this point. The more I'm thinking about your argument, I'm thinking you've convinced me that this is more like a landlord-tenant.
No, because, again, harboring doesn't require control. If control would be required under Ketting, he had sufficient control. But this isn't like a landlord-tenant relationship because he had control over the property. He paid for these people's bills. I mean, if you're sheltering and giving food to the dogs, he is knowingly providing a place for these dogs and the family to live and helping them with their bills so they can eat. A landlord doesn't do that.
Let me try this once more. If someone owns vacation property, and they allow a relative to spend a week or 2 weeks at that vacation property, knowing that the relatives have dogs, and the dogs bite somebody, is the owner of the property going to be responsible for those dog bites or not? And if not, why?
Well, again, the whole facts have to be considered, so that's probably an incomplete hypothetical because we don't have all the facts. But if it's a, we're just letting our relatives use our property for a week and it's transient, not permanent like we have here, and they're really letting the relatives use it, I mean, the big distinction here is that Mr. Contos purposefully bought this property to accommodate the pets. And the rental property, that would not be the same situation.
Counsel, I have to interject. And please, Justice Prosser, I don't mean, you've said to accommodate the pets, and that's at least the fourth time you've said some permutation of that. I remember reading the transcript, and the transcript made reference to two horses, I think. And that was, I don't remember the part of the transcript where it said he had to provide them with a house so they could have dogs. I remember the horses, but I don't remember the dogs.
But he knew they had two dogs at the
time. Well, that's a little different from saying he had to provide the house in order to accommodate the dogs.
Well,
right? The record is that it was two horses.
He did say the horses, but he also knew that there were the dogs.
And the horses, though, were the reason for the purchase of that property, or one of the reasons, according to the deposition transcript.
There was a mention of the horses, but my recollection was there was, I thought he said pets as well, that there was a follow-up question regarding pets, but there was a knowledge of the two dogs.
Sure. Now, I understand that. Of course he knew there. You make reference to him telling one of them to stand back or something when a visitor was there. Sure, he knew there were dogs, but sorry, Justice Prosser, I just wanted to clarify that part. He wants an answer to his cabin question.
And all the facts, when you consider a cabin owner, are they knowingly sheltering a dog in the same way? Are you providing shelter and lodging in the same way that Mr. Contos was providing shelter for his family and their pets here? I think that would be a different situation. And that may be a ground where perhaps under the statute you would be strictly liable and then the public policy factors might be employed in that case. But in this particular case where it was a permanent situation where he knew that they had dogs and they got more dogs. He knew the dogs were rough and unruly. He yelled at them at least once, three times on one day, according to Ms. Augsburger, when she was present. Given all of the facts here, he was providing shelter to those dogs under the analysis in Pawlowski.
Tyndall, you've gotten several hypotheticals here, Ranging from not family to the cabin and others in between. And the response I hear from you is that there are several factors to be looked at in terms of deciding whether this owner of the land and house is a keeper or a harborer. Tell me, are you arguing harbor or keeper?
We're arguing harbor.
Okay. Now, and let me talk about some of these factors and see if I have the ones you intend. One, and they're not necessarily in order of importance, but this is a permanent, in quotes, because we don't know how long she's staying, but a permanent facility or place for the dogs is distinguished from the two-week cabin, okay? And the permanency is a factor. Another factor here, it's a family relationship rather than commercial. A third factor is that this property was purchased with the intent that this family unit use this home for a family purpose, namely taking care of the mother. Third, the owner of the property is giving financial support to the family living in the house and therefore giving financial support to the dogs, feeding, care, vet, whatever it is. Although the title and ownership of the property is in someone other than a resident of the property, that's not a controlling factor. Another circumstance is that the owner of the property, he had the power to control the dogs, therefore disciplined. When I say disciplined, yelled at the dogs or told them what to do and not to do. That the owner of the property had control over whether there would be any dogs on the property and could get rid of the dogs or give the family unit the opportunity to get rid of the dogs or get out of the house. That the owner of the property knew about the dogs. That there's somewhat of a dispute about knowing about the dogs, whether the fact here was that there'd be an intent to shelter the dogs or whether there's just an intent here to shelter horses. But that goes to the intent. Now, if I left out a factor that would be considered in any of the hypotheticals or in this one, you can tell me what it is. And any time any of these factors change, like 2 weeks to permanency, then the rule that's set forth in this case may or may not apply to another set of factors, but you are giving it a totality of the circumstances.
Correct. And in terms of the intent to shelter the dogs were a part of the family when they came into the home. And in the Carr versus Van Oster case that the defendants rely on, the fellow moved into the home, lived there 2 years, and then acquired the dog. So although the law in that case is this different, and there's an avowed landlord-tenant case in that case, so that is also different.
Should I add as a fact that this is not a commercial landlord-tenant relationship?
Right. And the Court of Appeals analysis, in my opinion, got it right. They said, did he knowingly shelter the dog? Both the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals found that there was no question that he did knowingly shelter the dog. And in our view, that is dispositive. And I thank you very much for your time.
Could I ask one other question?
Justice Prosser.
Our statute talks about or defines owner, owns, harbors, or keeps. What is the derivation of of that language? Does that come out of the restatement, or no. Where does that come from? Is that universal language? Or
no, it is not universal language. And as, if you look at the restatement talks about owns or keeps, and that's why the common law liability for dog owners was for those who own or keep the dog. It appears that the word harbor was used in some dog bite statutes. Apparently in the beginning there were a number of dog-related statutes. The first one apparently was in the 1850s. There was one in 1870 related to you know, I think they initially came about because of problems with dogs attacking livestock. But under common law, you could be an owner or a keeper and be liable. And the statutory scheme added harborer, and that has been in some statutes since the 20s or 30s. But in Ketting versus Conroy, the 1936 version of the statute that we think is applicable here, that they did have harboring in there at that time as well.
One quick follow-up to my first question I asked you. I asked you for any the best case you have where someone who lives in a separate and distinct residence has liability for another's dog. The council cited cases from other jurisdictions as well. What's your best case in Wisconsin or anywhere?
I think it's a combination of Pawlowski and Ketting. In Ketting, an adult daughter lived
okay.
with her
I just
daughter.
Okay, I've got it. I've got the facts of those cases. I just thought maybe there was something somewhere else because he cited cases from other jurisdictions that you wanted to rely on.
Well, the Anderson case from Minnesota, and I thought there was possibly one more I saw just yesterday.
Just in your brief already. But you've got it. Okay, thank you. I'm sorry.
Mr. Habenoff, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. The question that was asked by Justice Ziegler was case law, and what was recited was the Ketting case, but the Ketting case is factually distinct and different from the Contos case, from this Augsburger case, excuse me. In the Ketting case, a father allowed his adult daughter to live with him in his own premises, not in a separate premises, like Contos and Augsburger. So the Ketting case does not stand for proposition that was argued that someone owns a separate piece of property would have liability. To answer Justice Prosser's question, if you agree with the argument proffered by counsel for Ms. Augsburger, it shouldn't make a difference how long the sheltering or harboring is, because it's to provide shelters, provide a place to live. We think that that is not what the law is, because all the cases that we cited and we talked about that talk about harboring, Patterman, the cases from the other jurisdictions, when they talk about harboring, they talk about specifically in those cases the care, control, and custody of those dogs. So it wouldn't make a difference under their analysis how long you were at your vacation home or if you kept your own boat on that property or anything else. If you allowed someone to go to your property with a dog and you let the dog live there and the dog bites somebody because you allowed that dog to live there for a period of time, you're responsible.
Counsel, how would you distinguish the Anderson case from Minnesota that counsel said is similar to this case?
The Anderson case, I think, has less precedential value because that case involved, it was a remand for on a summary judgment issue, not for the proposition in that case because that case was not ultimately decided on the issue because it was remanded and then settled. But even in that case, Justice, that case, if I can find my notes, talked about and in its decision said, quote, a harbor must do more than exercise control over the land upon which a dog resides. So
that was the case, though, that where you had the father own property in Minnesota, as I recall, he lived with his son in maybe North Dakota, South Dakota. His son came back and stayed in the house in Minnesota with a dog. And I think that case indicated that even though they didn't live together, that there could be liability, and then it was remanded.
That had peculiar facts, I'll grant you that, and it was tough to follow. But if we're looking at a case that's almost identical in the part, on all factors, is the Carr case from Kansas. They cite that the difference is that there was a rental agreement. There was some type of an agreement, but if you read the case, the father says it was $350, the son says it's $300. There wasn't a consensus that there actually was a formal agreement or what the amount was. And what's important is that, for this analysis, is that the son in the Carr case hadn't been paying rent for over a year. The father was providing the piece of property for his son and paying the property taxes on that piece of property. I think the example Justice Gableman used is dealing with a family farm situation where a family farmer allows or helps a son or daughter build a separate piece of a separate home on a separate acreage. They may not be paid for it. I think that is somewhat similar to where we have here, is that they're allowing, they're providing a piece of property for their child to live in, but that's the child's separate residence. And if they're going to have dogs there and they're going to control the dogs, they're the ones providing shelter. They're the ones that are providing control.
Would it make any difference if separate residence was in a mobile home in the backyard?
It may or may not. And it depends on the circumstances of the case as to how commingled the property was. In this case, it wasn't. It was 7 miles away. They weren't even on the contiguous piece of property. It was separate and distinct. In the Carr case, it was a mile apart, and there was some acreage that Mr. Carr had as a farm. In this case, Mr. Contos lives on the lake, and his daughter lives in the residence at Grandview. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pavanoff, and thank you, Ms. Tyndall, for your arguments today and for your briefs on another dog bite case has come to this court, and apparently they're quite frequent in other courts too, because I think that the statistics show that there are many dog bites. In fact, we also have two amicus briefs in this case, one from defense counsel, and then the other from the Wisconsin Association for Justice, taking opposite positions for that. Pardon me? Well,
counsel, we've all been there.
Well, I thought of confiscating your phone, which is the usual
hers broke the
punishment.
She liked the ring because she didn't get it,
but decided not to destroy it. So that ends it, and you may keep your phone. That concludes the argument in 12AP 641 Augsburger versus Homestead. And the court is in recess until 1:30, when it will hear the third oral argument today.